This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it. The phone is ringing again. That goddamn intern. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You miss the 90s? Yeah, I agree, man. The music scene was pretty incredible. Grunge, alternative, ska, Britpop, industrial, the punk revival, gangster rap. It was certainly a super creative decade for popular music, no doubt about it. What do you mean you're not talking about music? You missed the pre-internet days before our shitty rock and roll podcast. Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? Date Rape by Sublime? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Date Rape by mid-90s ska punkers Sublime. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line, Rico Ganu. How the hell are you?
Ganu's.
I'm fucking awesome, man. How are you?
Doing great, man. I feel pretty good. I got a solid 45 minutes of sleep last night. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, dude. Like, this fucking time change, it's only an hour, but it's this year, for some reason, I can't explain it. This year, it's really fucking with me, and I don't have an explanation. Usually, it doesn't affect me this much, but this year, I'm all fucking upside down, and I have no idea why.
Right there with you, man. I was ready for a nappy poo at about 2 o'clock today at work. I was done.
Yeah, no doubt, man. No doubt. Anyway, let's get right to it. So, we got to talk about Slash's new blues project. It's called Orgy of the Damned. I kind of like the name of the album. It's kind of rad. I don't have a problem with that. But the reason I want to bring this up, so they've got Killing Floor out. We've both listened to Killing Floor. A lot of people are talking about it. Killing Floor, written by originally Chester Burnett, Howlin' Wolf. Okay, we've got to give credit where credit's due. Let me ask you this, Scott. What do M. Night Shyamalan and Brian Johnson have in common? By the way, if there's anybody who listens to this that doesn't know who Brian Johnson is, I shouldn't have to explain that, but I will. He is the second vocalist from AC/DC. Think of Back in Black, present day, okay? So if you don't know who that dude is, get your fucking head out of the sand. It's Brian fucking Johnson, okay? So what do Brian Johnson and M. Night Shyamalan have in common, Scott?
They both see dead people.
Right, but no. So M. Night, the whole thing with M. Night Shyamalan and his movies, right? Like the I See Dead People movie. What was the big thing about his movies? The big reveal at the end, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's like M. Night's like thing is the big mind-blowing reveal at the end. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? You and I already knew this, but this song on this album is Brian Johnson's big M. Night Shyamalan moment, because guess what? This dude can really sing. And I bet you a lot of people don't really know that. Let me tell you, Scott, and I really can't wait to, I already know how you feel about this, but I want everybody to hear how you feel about this. I think that Brian Johnson should spend the rest of his life on this planet doing gritty blues tracks. And that's all I'm going to say.
I'm here for that all day and twice every day and twice on Sunday, as they say. But
yeah,
listen, dude, if you've spent the last 30 years listening to Thunderstruck, where Brian Johnson sounds like Gonzo from the Muppets, then you might be surprised for this M. Night Rama Lama Ding Dong reveal, where he comes out of nowhere and has this amazing singing voice. Rico, I submit to you, sir, that Brian Johnson in 1980, when he took over for Bon Scott, at that point, he was poised after the Back in Black album to be right up there with the greats of hard rock and roll, heavy metal. I'm talking nice book. Yep. I'm talking.
Thank you.
He would have been mentioned right alongside Ronnie James Dio, Rob Halford, the great hard rock metal vocalist. In fact, his vocal performance on the Back in Black album, in my opinion, is what sets it apart in the AC/DC catalog. But here's the trick. Another twist, if you will, an enigma wrapped up in a mystery. That performance is his only performance of its kind in the last 40 years that he's fronted AC/DC, only on that record. And he hits glassy high notes on that record. Listen to the call and response at the end of Shoot the Thrill. He has something that he's never incorporated in an AC/DC album since Back in Black, on Back in Black, that he does. And it's something that those of us who like music like to refer to as dynamics. Light and dark, high-pitched screams with offset by clean, non-distorted vocals. It's all there. It's a Herculean.
Dare I say peaks and valleys, ebbs and flows, right?
Yes, it's a Herculean vocal performance on that record. And if anybody watched his career in the 70s with Geordie, it's exactly the vocal performance they would expect out of him when he was named their new lead singer. But after Back in Black, we never get that again out of Brian Johnson and AC/DC. Yes, his voice sounds like Back in Black Brian Johnson on For Those About to Rock and Flick of the Switch, but he doesn't use any clean vocal in those albums. There's no glassy high notes. There's everything's distorted. Everything has grit. And then after that, he even takes it to another level where just for the rest of his career, it's just shrieking. And I can never figure it out, but I have a theory. My theory is, Rico, that Mutt Lange pushed him on the Back in Black album to sing in a register that he was capable of, but not comfortable in. And when he took that out on the road, the tour Back in Black, it destroyed his voice. So AC/DC got the singer they hired, who's fronted the band for the last 40 years, for one album. And then after that, he is never the same. And if you go back and watch old live footage of the Back in Black 1980 tour, he's not even trying some of those notes on stage. He's not even trying. So I think he could obviously get there when pushed, but I think when he took it out on the road, I think he very quickly realized, why did I sing that album so high? I can't do this for the next 40 years.
Listen, man, very, very well put. You want to know what I see, what I want to see? I want to see, like I said, I want to see Brian Johnson do gritty blues for the rest of his life, but there's more than just that. I want to see, now here's another guy who kind of maybe found his calling, so to speak, along with Brian Johnson. I want to see Brian Johnson and Keith Richards team up for a blues album.
Ooh, wow.
I think that would be spectacular. And I don't want Brian Johnson to do any more AC/DC. I want him to stop touring with AC/DC immediately. I want him to quit. I want him to stop doing that, what he was doing, and I want him to do nothing but blues for the rest of his life, because I think he sounds absolutely spectacular on this song. And any of you that haven't checked it out yet, it's Killing Floor. It's on YouTube. If you look at this album, like the track listing on this album, man, I can't wait to listen to the rest of these songs. This album is like a fucking all-star cast of really great people. I'm not even going to list them all. Goddamn, I can't wait to listen to this album. It's going to be awesome, dude.
Yeah, and to our listeners, if you haven't, go to YouTube and pull up the video. And let me just, one final point about this track, Rico, that I thought was really, really cool. The video, I thought, was super well done. And the thing I really appreciated about it was that it interwove, it was like a love letter to the guys who originally wrote and performed these songs. It interwove, like you get the black and white photos of Howlin' Wolf, and you see, so it, in other words, for culture vulturism, even though it's a cover of an old blues standard, I gotta give it a zero, because they completely owned it and paid homage to the creators quite literally in the video, which I thought was such a cool touch. You don't see that. We've been watching artists cover blues songs for 50 years now, and rarely do you see them ever actually kind of acknowledge the originators when performed, right? So I thought that was a really cool touch.
And that was that, everything was right about the way they did the song. I thought Steven Tyler was spectacular.
Oh, man.
Even though his part was not very prominent, it was just right. And all of his contributions were perfect.
Yeah.
And it's different when you're Led Zeppelin and you're ripping off blues guys and shitting on them and claiming it for yourself, and then coming back with, well, I'll just pay a few bucks and move on with my fucking life. What's the big deal with that? Versus this scenario where they're going out of their way, to your point, to actually give propers to the people who created this music. I think they couldn't have done a better job with it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm super impressed by it. And just a final note, Steven Tyler, I knew he could play the harp, but my goodness, he uncorks a solo.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah, dude. So again, this is Killing Floor off of the album Orgy of the Damned. I don't know when the rest of it's coming out, but I can't wait to May 17th is when the rest of the album comes out, so check that out. Let me ask you this, Scott. What month are we in?
It's March.
It's not even halfway through March, right?
Not yet. No.
Is it possible that you can go out of your way to claim that I know what my favorite solo guitar solo of 2024 is when we're not even halfway through the third fucking month?
Hey, listen, can you do that? Sure we can. All we do here is hyperbole and and takes that are completely unfounded and without base.
All right, so I listened to, and I'm sure you have listened to it more than once, Kerry King's song Idle Hands. The solo on that song by Demel, right?
Yeah,
that's nice. Okay, so the solo on that album was dubbed by Kirk Hammett as his favorite solo of 2024, Scott, and I submit to you since you submit things to me, I submit to you, Scott, that the only reason that he that this is his favorite solo of 2024 is because it is a Kirk Hammett solo. If you listen to it, it sounds just like a Kirk Hammett solo, which is precisely why he likes it. But I have a more important question for you. Considering the thousands of eight-year-olds that can play Eruption better than Eddie Van Halen on YouTube nowadays, is the solo a dying art? Is it irrelevant now because so many people on YouTube can noodle their way up and down a guitar neck like they're not even thinking about it? Is the solo not special anymore?
Are you aware that Marty Friedman just recently said that the traditional rock guitar solo needs to die? This was literally just in the news like a week ago. Of course you know. You're our newsman. Listen, couple thoughts on what you're saying, and I'll answer your question. One, you're saying that Kirk loves the solo because it sounds like Kirk.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
I listened to it, and I agree. You know what's funny? You know what my favorite podcast is of 2024? It's Rock and Roll Postmortem Dissection, starring Snot and Miko. It's my favorite. I love it. I absolutely can't get enough of that podcast.
It's the best podcast of 2024 so far.
It really is so far. But listen, dude, so is the rock solo dead? Man, I think about this all the time. For one thing, I don't really care for that Kerry King song or the solo, so I'll just go on record there.
Yeah, it was all right.
It was aight, right,
exactly.
But I don't know, man. I mean, the other day I was driving home and Sweet Child of Mine came on, and I've heard that song a gazillion times, and usually I'm just skipping past it. But I listened to it and the solo came up and I thought, you know what? If I was to make a list of the greatest rock and roll solos of all time, that solo might be on there. It is a great fucking solo. And so to answer your question, a really great rock guitar solo can still, to me as a listener, it can take me on a little journey. It can be the song within the song. You know, and it doesn't have to be even guitar, like a sax solo or something, you know, some kind of instrumental break in a song that can just like an instrumental break in a song I never, ever, ever tire of, no matter how many times I hear it, is the Tom Sawyer break that ends in Neil Peart's insane drum climax. I've heard that song a million times. I don't ever want to hear the song again, but it's like when Goodfellas is on TV and you're flipping through the channels, you just stop and watch. You have to,
right?
I always listen to that part because it still after 40 years blows me away. And I mean, listen, the eight-year-olds on YouTube and Reels shredding Eruption, I guess you're asking is the fact that it's so ubiquitous and so common, has it taken away its impact? Has it lessened its importance? Maybe in that context it has, like in a reel or in a YouTube short or in a YouTube video, it's no longer impressive to me when I see somebody shredding that because I've heard it so many times. But in the context of a great song, a killer solo or instrumental break of some kind still to me matters, you know? So I'm going to come out pro solo, but with the caveat that it's somebody had to take care to write a good song around it, and then I care about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. Couldn't have said it better myself. Hey, listen, let's take a break, Scott. You wanna?
Yes, sir.
All right, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk some date rape, dude. I can't wait.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out. Either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host the Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres, and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, all right, gang, welcome back. Listen, once again, I can never say it enough. Thanks to all of you guys and girls and women and children and men and everybody out there for taking the time to listen to us babble on about random bullshit. Very much appreciated, actually. So let's get to it, Scott. So in 1985, date rape came out. Not the concept of date rape. That's been around for a very long time, unfortunately. No, I'm talking about the song Date Rape from the album 40 Ounces to Freedom. '95 was the re-release. The original is 91. My bad. Devotion Accuracy Department's going to get on me for that one. The label is Gasoline Alley / MCA, Scott. I know that means a lot to you in the context of our autopsy, but I wanted you to know that. Songwriter Marshall Goodman and Brad Noel, another victim of the heroiny 90s, unfortunately, and producer Sublime. So, dude, date rape, man. Did this song rape rock and roll to death? I don't know. We're going to find out.
Yeah, Rico, boy, this is going to be, I got to admit,
I'm trying to make the PMR, I'm trying to make the list, man.
I have a strong constitution, and I'm I don't fear much, but
yeah,
saying the words date rape over and over again throughout the latter half of this podcast has me a little weirded out, but I'm going to get through it.
Yeah. Hey, that we do what we have to do, all for the good of rock and roll, Scott.
All right, let's do it. This is Rock and Roll Autopsy. The band is Sublime. The album 40 Ounces to Freedom. The song Date Rape. The question is, did it kill rock and roll? Well, dear listener, you might be wondering, how in the hell do these clowns from Akron, Ohio figure out If certain songs from throughout rock and roll history killed rock and roll, well, we use the power of science. That's why we're wearing these lab coats and have scalpels in our hands and blood.
With nothing on underneath.
Yes, with just our schlongs dangling underneath the lab coat, smacking against our thighs.
Swing!
Swing!
Tentpole!
Too much. Might be like a little Vienna sausage, just lightly tapping the edge of my thigh.
Right. And it's even more awkward when you have the Vienna sausage and you still have Winterbush so that it looks even smaller.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me. Yikes. You got to engage in some hygiene. We use proprietary science, damn it. And it consists of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. Rico, the song is Date Rape. The band, Sublime. The category, gratuitous boomerism. How do you score, sir?
You know, when we talk about this category, gratuitous boomerism, sometimes it's not always just about the Clint Eastwoods of the world, the get off my lawn guys of the world. It's about, is there something conceptual about this song that doesn't translate from generation to generation? Okay. I absolutely think that this particular song, the style of music, I am a big fan of this style of music. I'm a big 311 fan, and 311 and Sublime are kind of like brothers. They're siblings, along with bands like No Doubt and maybe some other ones. But yeah, the subject matter of the song, we'll get into that. The style of music, we'll talk a little bit more about that maybe. The guys, I don't know how old they are, but I'm pretty sure they're like around our age. Dude, for me, this is a clear zero. There's nothing boomer about this song, in my opinion.
Listen, they're all Gen Xers. I did look up their ages, every one of them. And one, had he survived, they would all be in our window. So they are all Gen Xers. So
yeah,
I can't score them a 0.5 just for being boomers. There is a boomer, however, who uses this song as his theme song. He happens to sell Jell-O pudding pops and was once in a very popular 1980s sitcom as a doctor.
Ted Nugent?
Yeah. He's famous for wearing really bad sweaters and once hosted Fat Albert. Any idea?
Hold on. Before you go any further, I hate Bill Cosby because now Fat Albert has a really negative connotation attached to it. If anybody, the message that Fat Albert portrayed every episode was there's always this ridiculously positive message with Fat Albert. Not only was the show entertaining, it was funny, it was educational, it made you use your noodle a little bit, and there was everything 100% right about that cartoon, and now it's got this big giant black mark on it because of that dumbass. And I feel bad because a lot of people who haven't seen that cartoon that would get something out of it are never going to watch it because of him.
I agree 1,000%, man. It bums me out, dude. I'm the biggest Bill Cosby fan in the world. Yeah. When I grew up as a kid, my parents would play those records in the living room. Bill Cosby himself,
God. Remember when stand-up, great performance.
Yes. Remember when stand-up comedy used to be like records that people would play at parties? My parents did that. They had like, this shows how old I am, but they had Bill Cosby himself. They had Newhart. My dad loved that Red Fox one. So I grew up listening to that crap. I love Bill Cosby. Fat Albert, sure. Cosby Show, his stand-up. So fucking depressing about that crap.
Listen, definitely.
I'm giving it a 0-2, man. I don't see it. Let's move on. Oh, God, I've been dreading this all week. Category 2, excessive misogyny. Hey, Rico, I've got the lyrics available if you'd like to hear them.
You know, nothing would tickle my eardrums more than to hear some spoken word from you.
Here we go. Trigger warning.
Yeah. What is that? NSFW. W, please mind your volume.
All right. Let me tell you about a girl I know, had a drink about an hour ago, sitting in the corner by herself in a bar in downtown hell. She heard a noise and she looked through the door and saw a man she'd never seen before. Light skin, light blue eyes, a double chin, and a plastic smile. Well, her heart raced as he walked in the door and took an empty seat next to her at the bar. My brand new car is parked right outside. How'd you like to go for a ride? And she said, wait a minute, I have to think. And he said, that's fine. May I please buy you a drink? One drink turned into three or four, and they left and got in his car, and they drove away someplace real far. Now, babe, the time has come. How'd you like to have a little fun? And she said, if we could only please be on our way, I will not run. And that's when things got out of control. She didn't want to. He had his way. She said, let's go. He said, no way. Come on, babe. It's your lucky day. Shut your mouth. We're going to do it my way. Come on, baby. Don't be afraid. If it wasn't for date rape, I'd never get laid. Rico, do you need any more lyrics?
I think I've gotten my fill for this week. Thank you for that. See, here's the thing with this. We talked it up as if it was this big controversial song and how the lyrics are super colorful and we feel uncomfortable talking about it, but it's actually quite the contrary, Scott. Let me take you into the Wayback Machine. When Brad Noel got the idea for this song, when he was at a party actually, and he overheard somebody saying that very thing, Scott, could have been joking around, maybe he was serious, who the fuck knows, but he overheard somebody say, man, if it wasn't for date rape, I'd never get laid. And it actually put a thorn in his mind that actually inspired him to write the song. So this is actually a positive cautionary tale. It's actually a pro female song. It's very forward thinking. Goes right into this time period when female rockers, that my favorite time period, you know, Lil Fair and Tracy Bonham and all that shit that I like. Yeah, dude, like there is zero. The fuck am I thinking?
Misogyny?
Right. There is. I zapped out there for a sec. There is zero misogyny in this. It's quite the opposite. This is a pro female, very positively written song, and I love it for that. It's going to get a zero for me.
I got to read the quote from Wikipedia that you're referencing, because as someone who's defending.
Did I fuck it up?
No, you nailed it, but I want to read. Oh, okay. There's nuance, I think, to it, and I would like to read it verbatim, assuming that this is an accurate transcription of what the young man said at the time, because for someone who's trying to explain why the song was written, he does what I think is kind of a poor job of defending it. let me read it.
Yeah.
Starts out, says, Bradley Noel explained, I've never raped anyone, at least as far as I can remember. At least as far as I can remember. We were at a party a long time ago, and we were all talking about how much date rape sucked. This guy named Stanley was like, date rape isn't so bad. If it wasn't for date rape, I'd never get laid. Everyone at the party was bummed out about it, but I was cracking up and wrote a funny song about it. So our buddy Bradley here, RIP, and found some real sincere humor in the comment that this guy made.
I didn't read the entire wiki article, and I did kind of fuck it up a little bit, but I was partially correct. Dude, that's, you know what that sounds like? That sounds exactly like it was coming from a surfer stoner from California, which is exactly that band, Surfer Stoners from California. And so, and in their mid-20s for that matter, like what kind of dumb shit did we say when we were in our mid-20s? So yeah, okay, my fault. I didn't read the rest of it. I only read what I thought was enough. But the point is he got the idea from the song from a party that he went to, and okay, and he thought it was a big joke. But even though it was a big joke, the message actually, I think what came out of the song was not exactly what he was intending, and it's actually not a bad message. It's I don't know, dude. I'm still giving it a zero.
I also like the fact that in the lyrics later on it uses the phrase date rape styly, which
styly, I know. 311 uses that word a lot too.
Yeah, so does Chili Peppers. Yeah. And so it's just kind of but one thing that's interesting lyrically about the song is that the woman, and I see your point, and I could just as easily score it a zero. I'm going to score it a one only because, well, not only because, but primarily the woman who's the victim of the song, it's not really about what happens to her and the trauma she has to endure. It's more about the revealed trauma in act three of the song that the man right. has to endure. And that is, so in other words, the entire focus of the song isn't the victim. It's actually the dude who's the creep is kind of like, he's the center of the song and what happens to him, you know? And so, I don't know, man. I'm going to give it. I just can't imagine. Anytime I struggle with these sorts of things, and I've been a dude my whole life, so I can't get in the mind of how a woman would feel about things. But I think of my wife, and I think of what her thoughts would be about this song. And for that reason, I'm going to give it a big plus one. Let's move on. Wanton Whiteness, Date Rape by Sublime. Rico, what say you?
Ooh, tricky. This one's a little bit tricky for me. One of documented, okay, so I don't think that I'm fucking this up. Maybe you and Mark can clear this up for me, since you guys are so keen on like actual accurate information. But the style is reggae based, reggae ska. Fishbone was an influence of theirs. Any time you insert this style of music, the guys all in the band could be white stoner surfers. I don't really care. This is not, I mean, I guess if you look at it from the perspective of how white of you to appropriate something that, I don't think they're appropriating anything, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I think they're just enjoyed this type of music because of where they're from. And I think ska and reggae and their version of it is pretty fucking cool. And I don't think there's wanton whiteness in it. It's my opinion. So it's going to get a zero for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just because you mentioned Fishbone, just for people out there who might enjoy factoids, Fishbone actually...
Did I fuck this one up too?
No, you're fine. I don't think you fucked up that quote. I just think there was I just think he had, you know, a few contours around it that
I'm just messing around.
Didn't exactly reflect on the young man positively. But speaking of Fishbone, they actually covered this song in 2005 on a Sublime tribute album. Interesting note also is that Ron Jeremy starred in the video for this. So you have a someone who was accused of sexual assault playing a judge and later a rapist in the video. But I digress.
Right.
And back then he was just the hedgehog.
And got convicted of being a real rapist.
That's right. There's all kinds of nuance going on here.
Oh,
but
sure.
Wanton Whiteness. Stylistically, yes. Sky, I dig the guitar solo in this. Vocal delivery is good. Subject matter. Ah, gosh. I don't know. We go into
it's tough,
a whole,
right?
Yeah, the whole third act of the song is where I get a little, I almost feel if I were going to critique the lyrics of this song, I feel like it would have been a more powerful song without the butt stuff in the second half. If you haven't heard the song before, the man goes to jail and is raped in prison. And I feel like, I know I get the irony, yada, yada, but I almost feel like it would have been a more powerful song. It almost feels like at that point, especially in the way it's delivered, it goes a little too, I don't want to say too far, because we're talking about a song called Date Rape, but it just, I don't know. It's not the payoff that I want at the end of that song.
See, I don't mind the irony of it. Like, the point is the irony. It's like, if you do this, this dude did this and then went to jail and got his comeuppance. He got exactly what he was delivering. And the irony of it, I think, is what is the payoff of the song.
But it feels like the song is like uncomfortable and gross in the first couple verses. And then it feels like it's playing for laughs at the end. So the tone of the song to me, it feels disjointed, because the first few verses when he's actually taking advantage of that woman are super creepy and uncomfortable. And then the right. second half, it feels like it's just playing for jokes because, hey, butt stuff is funny, you know? And that's like, it's completely disjointed to me. I mean, it's like,
I could see that.
I mean, I don't know. I've never been raped in prison, but maybe then I would not, you know, I would not take it like they were playing it for jokes. But I have, when my wife buys the cheap toilet paper, had my digit break through when wiping.
Oh, God.
So,
yeah. So how many times? And I can understand if it happens once, because, you know, everything, you know, accidents happen. But how many times have you accidentally checked your own oil?
Oh, numerous times. We went through a window of time where, you know, money was tight. We had young babies and we're just looking to save money wherever we went and wherever we could, you know, on the grocery bill and whatnot. We started buying the cheap toilet paper. And I swear to God, every time I wiped myself, I was slipping a digit. And I was like, enough, we got to go back to buying the hardcore stuff, man. I'm too powerful a wiper. I mean, I'm applying so much pressure when I wipe that I was constantly checking my own oil.
Fucking single ply toilet paper, man. Like if you want to fuck with somebody, like buy single ply toilet paper. And then ask them to wipe their creamy ass afterwards with that shit. It's never going to happen, dude. It's going to be all over the place.
You know, when I used to walk my daughter when she was young down to the bus stop at 6 fucking a.m. in the morning, there was a mom out there with her kid. And I would say hi to her every morning and she would forget my name. And one day I told her, toilet paper. And she remembered my name from then on out.
Ever since.
Scott.
Are you pleased that your name is associated with something that touches somebody's dirty ass?
Yes, actually, I derive a great deal of pleasure from that. It gives my name credibility. Thank you very much.
And that, my friend, is the correct answer to that question.
And the correct answer for wanton whiteness is zero. Let's move on. Malignant machismo. Rico, what say you?
Wow, malignant machismo. Like, this song is so, like, tongue in cheek, and his delivery is so non-macho. It's just so you got me thinking now, because the way you described the little bit of how it's disjointed, like the beginning half is not quite delivered in the same vein as the second half of the song. And so, but that doesn't give it malignant machismo, in my opinion. I'm just not seeing anything at all. It's not that it's pleasant or anything. I'm not seeing anything that I would call malignant machismo anyway. So for me, it's getting a zero.
For me, I think that if a woman were going to write about this topic, it would be done so with almost like Paula Cole's Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? It would be done
nice,
thoughtfully. It would be done with a somber, kind of sober approach. It would cut to the heart of it would get to you in a real visceral way. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. The song would fucking affect you if a woman wrote this song, right? When a dude writes this song, he's clumsily playing for laughs in the second half with date rape styly. The she lies, that little slut. I mean, it's just going for the second half of the song is just going for laughs. And so I think for that, for the fact that, and it's okay to go for laughs. It's just, you know, we did Don't Call Me Dude a long time ago, but that song tonally is consistent kind of throughout. You know, you can have a song that's got two different tones. There's no rules. I'm not saying there's rules here. I'm just saying that a dude's approach to this song, especially a 20-something California dude in the 90s, compared to how a similarly aged woman approaches Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, totally different approaches to women dealing with men in society. And I just know that if a woman were to write this song, it'd be super sober and it would just cut to you. It would be visceral. It would be an uncomfortable listen for asshole dudes in the world. This song, dude, it's only dudes would write this kind of the way it's written. I couldn't see Gwen Stefani doing this at the time.
I kind of
even
see
though she was with the ska thing. So I'm going to score it a 1 for Malignant Machismo. Not because it's not macho in the Hetfield stance sense, but macho in the way men are often oblivious to what is kind of appropriate in the eyes of the fairer sex. What's fair game for humor?
You ever hear like when you're like fucking around with somebody and you're talking about something that you would not want to happen or some kind of something sort of like this, and you're like, yeah, it's all fucking fun and games, right? I feel like you know the context in which I'm saying that, right? I feel like this song is written by dudes for dudes, and the whole overarching message is, yeah, you think it's funny, motherfucker, it's all fun and games, but I think it's that type of a song. It's not a song for females. It's a song for dudes. It's exactly that. It's a song for dudes that's like, yeah, motherfucker, it's all fun and games, isn't it? Until you wind up in jail and the same shit's happening to you. And if you try to make it serious and impactful, like Paula Cole's Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, which really those songs are probably mirrors of each other, like those songs could be fraternal siblings, if you will, then I don't think the song delivers the same message, and I don't think it's as popular as it wound up being, and I just think that it would just fall off the cliff and nobody would ever pay attention to it. I could be wrong on that.
No, actually, can I comment on that?
Yeah,
I think that's a really great point, and I hadn't seen it from that perspective. So you've offered a perspective that I didn't consider, the fuck around and find out kind of perspective. But it's sad to me, though. I would still score it a 1, and I'll tell you why.
Yep.
Because it's sad to me that men, in order to reach out to other men to convince them that date rape is wrong, have to say, well, you'll be punished for it and you'll have to endure a punishment as awful as prison rape, and that should deter you from doing it. Not the argument that, hey, it's wrong to rape women, okay, which should be good enough. It's the fact that you have to, that's not enough. The man's not buying that. You know, that's not enough of an argument. You have to then say, well, if you do, you'll have to suffer this punishment. And that is supposed to be the deterrent for the male to stop his rapey ways. It's just pathetic that the argument just can't be, you can't convince this individual through just the simple fact of it's wrong. You know what I mean? That doesn't work. The fact that a woman is being victimized isn't convincing enough. It has to be, oh, you will be raped if you don't stop doing that. You could endure this punishment. So
yeah,
you've offered me a perspective I didn't consider. I think it's valid, but I also think it makes it even more pathetic. So let's move on. Culture vulturism, date rape, sublime. Yep.
Sublime. Yep. Yeah, let's dude. Yeah, no way, man. Again, they didn't invent ska and they didn't invent reggae, but certainly they're not appropriating somebody else's. They weren't appropriating reggae and ska and putting it together and putting a little bit of bluesy in there and sometimes a little bit of heavier guitar and some of their other material. But there's, in my opinion, there's no way that they could be accused of any culture vulturism. They just, I think like bands like No Doubt and these guys and 311 and some of the other ones that have this similar style, they're all just fit in a bubble style of music, and although they were inspired by other bands like Fishbone, they weren't ripping anybody off, which is the point of this category, like Led Zeppelin, like that we mentioned so many times. So for me, this is a real big fat zero.
Yeah, I would give it a zero too. I think they were just part of a movement of that era, the mid-90s, yep, of early post-grunge movement when ska kind of had a moment. You had the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, mm-hmm, Smash Mouth were a part of it, you know, another dead lead singer in that band. I mean, so, I mean, I, you know, of course you mentioned all of them, but there was a literal movement. This music kind of had a time in the spotlight for a brief window during that super, we've talked about it a million times, that super creative window that kind of happened in the mid-90s before butt rock and nu metal came into prominence in the late 90s. So
real quick, sure. I always mentioned Fishbone, and I knew there was somebody else that I should have keep mentioned in all of this. Another big ska band in the 80s that influenced a lot of these people, especially like No Doubt, Madness. So big shout out to Madness. They did a real popular song called Our House, and they're a big ska band too. So I couldn't talk about this kind of music without mentioning Madness. So my bad on that. So go ahead.
Yeah, very cool. So yeah, so I would give it a zero as well, man. I think this band was just a part of a scene. And so I think you can be a part of a scene without appropriation. You know what I mean? It's like if you're just kind of a part of a movement, it was just a thing that it was one of those weird little quirky things where it's like, hey, ska got really big for a couple of years in the mid-90s, you know, and it did.
So, it did, for sure.
Anyway, all right, Rico, are you ready to tally this mug up?
Let's do it.
All right, so what have I got here? I've got 2 points. 2 points.
And I've got, let's see, 38 divided by 2, carry the 9. I've got 0.0.
All right. 0.0. This is going to be tough on you, buddy. For a grand total of...
That's only 2 points, Scott. So although this song is a little odd, we've talked about why it's odd. We've talked about how it's odd. But not only did this song not kill rock, dude, it contributed to rock. This is a really good song. It's fun. It's entertaining. It delivers a good message. The music style is really unique and memorable. There's a lot of good things about this song, although it's a little quirky and a little odd in some ways.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm not a fan, to be honest with you, but I can appreciate it. And I do like some of the music, but I wasn't super into this movement and this song. I love the guitar solo. I dig the vocal delivery is inspired in places. It's fascinating to me that this song became a hit back then. It just shows how different the times mm-hmm. are. I could never see something like this today. Having a moment where it's like you had people, is the song went nuts with like radio requests back in the day. It's just kind of interesting. I encourage anybody to do some reading about it. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I, you know, when Sublime was popular, I didn't dislike Sublime, but they were just never my jam. I was a 311 guy, which, like I said, they're similar to these guys, but they're a little heavier and a little jazzier. And so, I always enjoyed the song. Sublime was never one of my go-tos, kind of like you. So.
All right, man. Well, you feel good about it, dude?
I do. Science wins always.
Science wins always. All right, Rico, let's wrap it up, man.
Sounds good. Thank you for joining me tonight, Scott.
Yes, sir. Thank you for coming along for the ride. We'll be back next week. It's been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Who is it? Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
Guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica, and Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.